Hello, and welcome to Mondays on Tuesdays podcast. I am your host, Firecrow Silver Knight, and I have a variety of topics today. I hope it mixes together well. I'm talking about two patterns that I believe have overstayed their welcome in our world. One from 100 years ago, and one from 200 years ago or so. And these two things are, number one, the idea that being first is the most important thing in business, which if you've been paying attention, the largest airline companies are not named the Wright Brothers airline companies, and the operating systems that we use are not called the Unix operating systems. We are using Windows, macOS, and Linux for the most part, Android phones, iOS phones, and Unix was created at Bell Labs, and there's like a specification called POSIX for compatibility, but realistically, Linux was based on Minix, which was an educational system that Linus Torvalds had, legendary debates with his professor. And he was talking about efficiency. The professor was talking about clarity of having services, user services, and core kernel services that don't share memory at all for the sake of cleanliness and composability. And supposedly, the big argument from Linus was, but that's inefficient to not have them share. And he got worked up about it and then wrote Linux. And Linux is awesome. But he wasn't first. Even the, the Git source control system, which is widely popular, it's actually amazing. It wasn't first either. There was something called BitKeeper that was the same model, not quite right. There was a game called 2048 that took the New York City subway by storm. If you were on the train when that came out sometime in the mid-2010s, I think, everybody was playing 2048. Well, 2048 was based on a game called Threes that I've played, and it's wonderful and a lot slower. So this idea of being first is not really what determines success in business. Quality and delivery and customer retention are far more important. And then the second concept I'm going to talk about is the idea of memorization-based education. And the first subject I'm going to talk about is the background of the Rothschilds banking network in the 1800s. And the second one I'm going to talk about is Rockefeller's influence in the Board of Education that was created right around the 1900s, and the focus on memorization for the purpose of training corporate workers for the manufacturing world of the time. And then I'm going to talk about pattern recognition and what certain patterns are for, and explain a bit about why facial recognition tends to fall down in terms of accuracy. And I'm also going to talk a bit about convention and my personal struggle with having an oversized paranoid reaction to anything involving popularity. And the reason I'm going to talk about that is because there's a thing called logical fallacies. Logical fallacies are things people introduce into discussions to more or less make them no longer discussions. And one of the logical fallacies that I believe has troubled me the most is something Latin, something populum. And it basically means just because it's popular doesn't mean it's true. And this is used to squash a lot of reasonable conversation where I would have some insight or I would see something and I was met with, well, but that's not the popular way to do it. I'm not going to discuss the logic or the observations or the experience you have, no matter how right or wrong they are. We're just going to go with what's popular. And I think that hit me so hard over the years that I actually now like stubbornly refuse to do something just because it's popular. I mean, we've all knocked pop music or known someone who's knocked pop music. And then when it comes on in a store you're in or a restaurant, everybody's, tapping along because it's good music. It's fun. It doesn't take away from the music itself the fact that it is popular. And come on, we can all admit we like pop music, at least a little bit. So Compare Basic is integrating with the Python language, and that is hoping to bring visibility and access to people to use, and I will get over my need to be super unique back after the break. So the story, as it goes, of the Rothschilds making a ton of money based on information. It's a very interesting story, not because it is in itself an interesting story. The story is that the Rothschild family set up banks in Frankfurt, London, Paris, Vienna, and Naples sometime between the 1700s and the 1800s. And Napoleon lost a battle, and they knew about it before anybody else. What happened next was, supposedly, the Rothschilds sold a bunch of treasury bonds, assuming that Napoleon had won. And then people thought that Napoleon had won. And so they also, oh my God, we got to sell our treasury bonds too. We don't want to be left in the dust. And when that happened, the Rothschilds bought them back for a fraction of the cost. And then when the knowledge arrived that Napoleon had actually lost, people rebought bonds and the price went up and the Rothschilds made lots of money. It's a pretty classic trading story of any securities, bond stocks, the sort of speculative, information insight makes the world go round. And that's one of two interpretations of the phrase buy low, sell high, is buying a security low and then selling it for a higher price. The other is buying something in an area where it is not very valuable. Say you're buying, rice in Asia, there's lots and lots of rice patties. And then you bring it to America where, we don't have a lot of rice, but we have a lot of corn. And so you can sell it at a higher price than you could in Asia. There's two conditionals on this idea that you can, make bank by, buying low, selling high. The first is that a lot of that buy low, sell high, and when it comes to goods in different locations, was assuming that transportation was rare enough that it would be hard for other people to engage in the transportation. And we've seen distribution from, packages come to your door, in a few days, and tankers and planes are always going all over the world. So distribution has gotten so much cheaper that buy low, sell high is not so advantageous anymore. When it comes to securities, bonds, and stocks, there's a theory called the efficient market hypothesis. And the efficient market hypothesis is the idea that there is enough information around such that the price is the right price. So there's no way to actually beat the market. And that kind of makes sense because all of the stories that I've heard recently about trading firms and what are they called? The fancy guys. Well, that term might come back to me. They're doing crazy risky things like short selling hedge funds. That's what I'm thinking. They're doing all these crazy risky things like short selling, which is nutso. I mean, the whole concept of short selling is super, super weird. I researched it at one point after the whole GameStop thing. And it looks like basically it's making money off of the fear of large organizations such that borrow a stock and promise to return it at a price less than what it's worth today, but more than nothing. And so if the company really totally, if the price falls out of the sky, you then can buy a cheaper version of it and return it for what you promised it, and you get the difference. It's super weird. If you get that wrong, if the stock price goes up, you have to buy it at the higher price and then return it for the discounted price you promised to the larger bank or larger trading institution. And so the risks are nuts. And I think the efficient market theory that makes perfect sense to me, which is the idea that there's enough eyeballs on stuff that there is really no way to beat the market, it's driving people into riskier and crazier things. And I think it kind of comes back to this idea that supposedly, as the first really multinational banking system, the Rothschilds made really a lot of money because they had information networks at the time that were far superior than anybody else. And the efficient market theory is more or less saying that kind of advantage is not really real anymore. And that Napoleon battle and treasury pump and dumpish thing was happened in 1815. So we're talking, around 200 years ago. And then the next thing that is kind of in the subject is the idea of education being heavily, heavily, heavily involved by people who run large companies and really just want a staff of workers, not really a, thinkers. And it really looks like, from my research, I have a link in the show notes, that Rockefeller really, really invested a whole lots of what's considered philanthropy in the education system around 1900, and there was a focus on standardization of curriculum and particularly in the direction of memorization. There was a lot of other independent school boards that were creating, local curriculums, and something crazy like his influence was responsible for consolidating like 75,000 school boards down to 15,000 so that they were easier to like keep in line or something. Also, all kinds of strange stories. When I was in high school, the George W. Bush administration had a whole song and dance about something called the No Child Left Behind Act, which basically meant they were going to hold kids back grades more often, which, can go down in the history books as one of the strangely, seemingly oppositely named acts. But the emphasis on standardization, number two pencils won't save the world is a phrase I like to kick around. And it was a whole lot more reliance on coloring in little bubbles of multiple choice questions rather than any teacher's interpretation of what grade someone should get. And yeah, I grew up not far away from, Pearson's, where I'm pretty sure the ITBS tests were created. IOTBS stands for Iowa Test of Basic Skills, and that was then rolled out to the country much earlier than the George W. Bush administration. But this idea of memorization as a form of education has kind of led to a follow the leader mindset, and I was really sad to hear that 100 years ago that was kind of the intention of the standardization of the Board of Education. I believe I'm getting this wrong. I think it's the General Education Board, the GEB. We'll see. I'll correct it in the notes if I'm wrong. But one of the things that this kind of leads to is an extreme reliance on book knowledge that already exists. This kind of idea of, the United States is a playground and there's nothing new to do. And I think that's part of the not explaining things from the beginning, resistance to reinventing the wheel mindset, is that we have this education pipeline that is held so high in terms of what you need to do and what you should model. And there's one thing within that sort of higher education mindset, particularly economics, which is the concept of using differential equations to understand financial things. And this comes kind of back to the idea of being first as the most important thing. If you can see the trends, you can be first. And also comes back to this idea of textbook memorization, which is that, there's a math formula you can apply instead of actually interacting with people and, running the business in a way that the business runs, whatever you are. If it's a manufacturing company, how do you manufacture valuable stuff? If it's a restaurant, if it's a legal firm, what angle's going to work with the jury, or what's your understanding of the law or the jurisdictions or the judges? I mean, there's a whole lot of transformation that can happen from interacting with the world and your staff in a very non-academic way. And differential equations are terrifying to me because they're so heavy on correlation. The sort of most obvious observation is like, it only snows when it's cold, but just because it's cold doesn't mean it's snowing. And what a differential equation actually is, it's a big, scary, upsetting sounding word, but it's basically a formula that determines the relationship between two things in motion or two trend lines. So the idea is, if you can figure out the relationship between one factor and another factor, then you can predict the future as the first factor changes, you can predict the second factor. And realistically, the trend lines are not stable. The trend lines are not, they don't include all of the factors. You have to actually go into the business to see that. And so the reliance in economics on differential equations, it's just a guess. It really is just a guess. And I found a wonderful paper that is linked in the show notes. And it's titled The Differing Impacts of Differential Equations on the Economy. And it talks about the Salo-Swan growth model, which from what I can tell is basically this idea of like the assets of the economy and the labor force makes the economy. And that's it. That's as deep as it gets. It talks about like as physical assets like farm equipment and other, they define capital not as just money, but capitals and assets as capital as well. You need investment in the economy to offset the declining value of the money and the physical stuff. And then the size of the labor force just kind of like defines the health of it. And that's a really shallow way of looking at the world. And then it talks a bit about how Black-Scholes was introduced as basically a more complex version of that, where it would map out the different aspects of different options in different scenarios over time. And Black-Scholes was so good that so many people started trading with it just before the 2008 crash. And the problem was that Black-Scholes wasn't actually predictive. It was just speculative, semi-differential equation-y stuff. And so when the volatility did not adequately predict the market, that was one of the main factors in the 2008 crash. And so I actually think that these two mindsets, the idea that education can be successful with memorization base only, and the idea that being first is the most important thing in business, I think both of these things have kind of tainted the idea that essentially business is a transformative process. It is using the resources that you have to transform them into a way that is either something someone doesn't want to do themselves, like cooking food, filing their taxes. Even if they had the ability to do it themselves, they want you to do it because you do it better, faster, or of a higher quality. And that transformative aspect to me is where all the magic is in rebuilding the economy, understanding how your personal skills apply to things, and kind of breaking out of this jail of estimative mathematical formulas and memorization. And to bring this, back into the computer science realm, I was thinking the other day about the number of times that I've heard reports that facial recognition is just not working as a full-on identity of someone the way that, fingerprints are, or, DNA from hair. And I got to thinking, my understanding of facial recognition is that the actual value of a face in a facial recognition system is the distance and relationship between your eyebrows and your nose, and your nose and your cheekbones, and your nose and the corners of your lips, and the corners of your lips and your chin, and the width of your face versus the top of your face. Size can't be a factor because it's very hard to tell relative sizing based on a photo or a video camera, and so it's all these like sort of ratios and positions of things. And when I look at pattern matching in computers and look at sort of the numerical scalability, what you sort of need to actually identify uniqueness across a big set of people. I mean, we're not talking about facial recognition for one town or one family. We're talking about, a whole country or a whole state or the whole world. It just doesn't seem like a unique enough set of data. And so what facial recognition is really, really, really good for is determining if it really wasn't the person. Like if you take a person you have in front of you who's been arrested or suspicious or something like that of a crime, and you take a picture, it's very easy to say whether or not it was totally not that person. But the best you're going to get with facial recognition is that it might be that person. And I'm linking to an article in these show notes that basically makes the case for why facial recognition is awesome. And it keeps quoting numbers like 99%, 90%, and the question I have, there's not a whole lot of details of where those numbers come from. The question I have is 99% of what? We know that you didn't run every single human through this thing. So, you know, did you run it by 100 people and one of them failed and that's, you know, representative of the universe now? And what's really, really interesting is that in computer science, there are some cases where you do want an approximate, definitely not this, rather than fully definitely this. And one of those examples is hash tables, which is a really interesting concept. It's the idea that if you put everything into a bucket, like let's say every letter in a Scrabble bag, and you had to find, I don't know, letter K. Maybe you're cheating, you're peeking at the bag in the game of Scrabble and you're trying to find the letter K. You have to dig through all of the letters at the top first to get down to the ones at the bottom, and it, you know, it's complicated. Well, if you were to sort them out, not that you can do this in an actual Scrabble game, but bear with me, it's an analogy. If you were to sort them out in, you know, the first five letters, every one of the first five letters, every one of the next five letters, every one of the next five letters, and you knew that K was, I'm going to guess, say in the third set, now you're looking through a smaller batch of letters. And this is an example of a pattern that you don't have to know exactly what it is. You'll do the actual comparison a little bit later. You're going to actually look at the K and make sure it's a K, but you need an approximate way of getting there. And there are actually a lot of areas of computer science where this type of, I think it's called a negative match, where you want to quickly identify that it's definitely not something cheaply. And there are just so many stories of, you know, like US immigration officers misidentifying people with facial recognition. Or I heard a story the other day where there were two children and one of them was from an ethnicity with darker skin, and they were able to approve their Roblox accounts for their friends as adults so they could keep playing Roblox because the darkness of their skin kept the facial recognition from recognizing them as a child. And you know, we're there's all these numbers about how amazing it is, and then you know, there's real life stories of it not being so amazing. So one of the things that I am trying to really understand is how can I best fit into what is popular? What do people actually need from software? Because I kind of have been spinning out a bit in terms of building really powerful stuff that has very little immediate application, immediate demonstration. And I know I've talked about, you know, on the podcast before that I carry a borderline personality disorder diagnosis, which, to be fair, I'm right on the edge of the clinical threshold. I achieved a remission diagnosis for bipolar disorder about 4 years ago. And then I found out that the reason for that remission diagnosis in part is because bipolar was the wrong diagnosis. But I like the idea of thinking of myself as having borderline because the research is fantastic. The idea of overreacting to boundaries between relationships, and I, you know, I have something to read and a place to put my focus in terms of psychology. And one of the things that people say a lot about psychology is like, oh, it's just a label. And yeah, you know, it is. But kind of like the idea that facial recognition is not a complete match. It also comes down to this idea that you know, a mental health categorization is not a complete match either, but it's a research angle of you know, it's something to find people who've had similar experiences and research them. And I have a to bring this full circle, I have this really interesting theory of what I don't know what to call this, but the idea is rather than businesses focusing on being first, what if businesses focused on engaging with people who had done something similar to what they had done and looking for what they can do in combination with that? Kind of like the treat the indication of an opportunity not as the full story, but as the beginning of the story. And then for the education bit, it would be very similar. It would be like, here's the starting point, but don't memorize what happened. Go in your own direction and figure out all kinds of details about things. And I actually think that this may be a bit of an abstract finish to the episode, but there's something in me that really believes that this idea of not treating academic knowledge as complete or not treating firstism as a conclusion, but as a starting place, it kind of maps to this idea of not treating a diagnosis as a label, but treating it as like a research opportunity. And so I'm really hoping that over the next few years, I can deliver a software system that can really get people involved in that investigative idea of, you know, treating the idea of being first as the beginning, not the end, and treating existing knowledge as a chance to broaden combinatorial, you know, research. And one of the areas I'm really interested in is accounting, as you can tell from previous episodes. And I'm really looking forward to making some visualization speculation tools that can, you know, get people really into the weeds of their businesses. And it's kind of sad at times to research the past and realize that, like, well, these, you know, 100 or 200 year old patterns have kind of overstayed their welcome. But there also seems to be tremendous opportunity in understanding some of the sort of roots of why things are the way they are, and then also the chances to overcome them. So as usual, if you like the things I talk about, there's more details at comparebasic.com, and I will see you next week-ish.